Hello, and welcome to another episode of Multifaithful. My name is Arianis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU. On this week's episode, I am joined by Chris Stedman, the Executive Director of the Humanist Community at Yale University and author of a wonderful book about interfaith called Faithiest, which you should definitely read. We discuss the role of humanists in multifaith spaces and how we can all do a better job of including people outside of the theist community in our interfaith work. Thanks for listening to Multifaithful, and have this week's conversation. I am joined today by the Executive Director of the Yale Humanist Community, Chris Stedman, as well as famous author Chris Stedman, author of the book Faithiest, which I know is one of my personal favorites in terms of books about interfaith and multifaith. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
So I wanted to start talking a little bit about what it means to be a humanist religious leader or a humanist leader. I don't know about religious, but because I know that when I'm speaking to people about the community we have here at NYU, one of the questions I get asked most frequently is, what does it mean to have a humanist chaplain? Because we have a wonderful humanist chaplain on campus. So maybe you could give to people who aren't familiar with that, like, what does it mean to be a humanist chaplain?
It's a good question. I mean, I'm sitting here laughing. I'm sorry, I'm not laughing at you. But
no, we aim to make people laugh.
But even, you know, in how you sort of frame this question, right? Mm-hmm. There's like multiple different ways of trying to describe what this is. Is it a humanist religious leader? Is it a humanist chaplain? I mean, and I think what that suggests is that like this is a complicated question, and like, you know, there's a lot of confusion or lack of clarity mm-hmm. around what this means. And so, you know, the answer that I'm going to give you is probably not the same answer that every humanist professional who does this kind of work would give, and so...
So you don't speak for all humanists of all shapes and forms?
No, I do not. Too bad. And I wouldn't even say that I probably speak for any other humanist professional other than myself. And, by the way, shout out to Ann Clayson, who is
our
wonderful.
Amazing humanist chaplain.
She is a huge inspiration to me, and every time I see her, I feel inspired to try to do this work even half as well as she does.
Also, one of our, she does our religious literacy workshops with me most frequently out of a lot of the other people at NYU. So she's a huge asset for our community. She's amazing.
She's wonderful. I think the easiest way to answer this question is to begin by saying that humanists, like all people, have needs and they have desires, right? We both need and desire community. We need and desire places to turn in times of need and crisis, as well as places to go to celebrate and to process. And a lot of these needs and desires that are fulfilled by religious communities are things that humanists also have a need to sort of address in their lives. And I'm of the mind that the best space to do those kinds of things is a space that is rooted in a particular worldview that reflects what your values are. And for me, that worldview is humanism. And for people who are unfamiliar with humanism, again, I won't speak for all humanists when I define humanism. There are lots of different definitions, mm-hmm. just as there are many different definitions of any religious tradition.
Yeah.
But this sort of textbook definition of humanism in the sort of modern sense in the sort of secular sense, mm-hmm. which is how it's most often used now, is that humanism is a progressive philosophy of life that without supernaturalism or without belief in any sort of divine agents affirms the ability and responsibility of human beings to live lives of personal fulfillment that also aspire to the greater good for all of humanity. So it's a worldview that essentially posits that we as human beings need one another, that no person is an island, right? Mm-hmm. That if I want to accomplish things, I need to work with others. And that I'm also better for doing so. That the quality of my life is improved when I work to elevate the quality of everyone's lives. That my well-being and welfare is inextricably bound up in the well-being and welfare of another person. And that going through life alone simply isn't an option.
Right.
And so humanists often will say that, you know, we rely on reason mm-hmm. rather than, say, revelation as the sort of source for how we make sense of life's difficult problems, but that reason is not, it, alone is not enough, right? That mm-hmm. reason has to be in the service of compassion, right? That we're not simply trying to discern through the collection of knowledge and the sharing of information how to live our best life as individuals, but rather we're trying to figure out how do we live the best life collectively that we all can. And that is, you know, the sort of the bumper sticker mm-hmm. definition of humanism is good without God. But to mm-hmm. me, if I was going to write that out, I would put all of the emphasis on good, and the without God right. is simply a sort of descriptive thing. You know, I don't believe in God. I live my life, you know, operating under the assumption that there aren't a God, or there aren't gods who are going to influence human affairs in any mm-hmm. way. And thus, I put my emphasis on trying to determine how to live the best life that I can in community with others.
Mm-hmm.
And so to get back to your original question, part of why I think it's important for humanists to have access to the same kinds of resources, the same kinds of support that religious communities have, is that the project of religion is the project of determining how to live the best life that you can mm-hmm. in relationship with others. And communities are religious communities are spaces where that project is lived mm-hmm. out. And humanists, I think, benefit from engaging in that same project, in determining collectively how to live our best life. And communities of accountability, where we can be held to our highest principles, where we can be held accountable to what we say we value most, and to this project of trying to live our best lives,
mm-hmm.
That those kinds of communities are of great value. And for those of us who don't identify as religious, we still, I think, can benefit from being a part of those communities.
Right. And so I'm curious, for a lot of the students who come to your community gatherings at Yale, maybe you could break down a little bit of where they're coming from. So are a lot of them people who grew up humanist and grow into humanist congregations? Are they people who find their foot in a religious community or exiting a religious community but still search for something that can function the same way as their religious community? Like, where are students coming to? Because I think a lot of people, humanism is not often mentioned with in sort of the same vein as like other religious groups. And so I wonder of if we can start to think about where these students are coming from. It'll help us think about better, which will be my next question, about how humanists then interact with other people. So I know a lot of what you've written about and talk about is the interfaith, including humanists.
Yeah. Well, it's a real mixed bag. And part of that is intentional on our part. I mean, we try to cast a really wide net, or we try mm-hmm. to, maybe a better image would be to say we try to leave the door open as widely as possible to be a space for people who simply find that they're not finding what they're looking for elsewhere. So a lot of the folks that come to us, you know, are perhaps best identified as seekers, searchers. We get a number of students who identify as religiously hybrid, mm-hmm. Who claim multiple religious identities. We get a lot of folks who say that they're, I would say probably a large percentage of the students that I work with and that we work with at the Yale Humanist community grew up identifying as religious and have sort of shifted away from that, but aren't necessarily, but I think they're still on a journey. I'm not sure they necessarily have landed where they're going to land.
Right.
And I mean, this is why I think not only is it important for there to be humanists working alongside religious clergy,
mm-hmm.
but I think that anyone who's doing chaplaincy work needs to be willing to accompany whoever they're serving, in
mm-hmm.
the case of the
yeah.
work that I do as students, needs to be willing to accompany a student wherever they're going. So I never have an agenda, right, of trying to move a student out of a religious worldview or into identifying as a humanist. My goal is to simply be a reflective partner and walk with a student as they you know, go on their journey of trying to figure out
mm-hmm.
how they identify, what they believe. I try to equip them with resources. I share personal reflections on perhaps experiences I've had of searching and questioning and trying to figure out what my identity was. But I simply do that to model, not to say that they should follow my path.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I mean, again, I think that any person who's doing chaplaincy work needs to be comfortable
walking
with any student, where even if they don't walk the same path that you're going to walk. So we do get, you know, I do work with some students who were raised humanist, but actually it was only, I've been doing this work for, you know, the better part of a decade now, and it was only 2 years ago that for the first time at one of the first student group fairs of the academic year that I had a new freshman walk up to me at the table and say that they had already identified as a humanist. It is pretty rare, to be honest, that I meet a student who says they grew up humanist, they've always identified as humanist.
It's also, I mean, in the data that I get, or kind of the statistics I get before the year, sometimes we get an incoming freshman. I don't even think humanist is an option for them to check.
Don't think it is either. But
so
it's
even if there were, I'm not even sure we'd be able to find them.
You know, I think that this is something that I've said before in conversations about this, but so much of the questions that people are asking right now about the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, the religiously unaffiliated, is why? Why are they disaffiliating from institutional religion? Why are they leaving? What's causing this? Is it because religious institutions have aligned themselves with certain politics? Is it because, as some data shows, a large number of millennials see religious institutions as too bound up in money? You know, and there's all kinds of conversation about these things. And those conversations are important. I wouldn't discount or downplay them. But I actually think, and from my perspective anyway, this is the case, the more important conversation is not why are they leaving, but where are they going, right? Where are these people, and not just millennials, but people of all ages who are disaffiliating from institutional religions, where are they going in times of crisis and need? Where are they turning to mark life events, to celebrate? And where are they going to be reminded that we have a responsibility to one another? You know, my mother, I think, I don't want to speak for her, but I think she identifies as agnostic based on what she said to me. But she goes to a Christian church. And part of why she goes is because she loves listening to the sermon, because it reminds her that she has a responsibility to other people. And she's told me that when she gets back from church after the, you know, hearing the sermon, she reflects on it for a long time. She, you know, calls that distant relative who's maybe doesn't talk to very many people and checks, you know, she does things that she doesn't normally remember to do. She's reminded that she has these higher values that she aspires to live out. And these spaces of accountability are, I think, you know, not having those spaces for non-religious people is going to be a huge problem. You know, I don't necessarily agree with every conclusion in this book, but I think a great book on this subject is Religion for Atheists by Elaine de Botton, who rightly, at the in the beginning of the book, says that he rightly identifies this problem, which is that secular society has largely failed to replicate some of the successes of religion, such as creating space for people to encounter the other, space for people to reflect on their values, to be reminded of what they're trying to do, and also space to actually act out those values. I mean, in American Grace, one of my favorite books to reference on this subject, Robert Putnam and David Campbell talk about how religious Americans are better neighbors than the non-religious. They give more money to charity, both religious charity and secular. They volunteer in their communities more, and so on. But, and this is, like, I think my favorite finding in the book, they also say that a non-believing spouse of a religious person who participates in their partner's religious community is just as civically engaged. And because of this, they suggest that the correlation between being religious and being a good neighbor has less to do with belief or what specifically you believe in, and more to do with belonging. It's about being a part of a community that holds you accountable to your values, that gives you opportunities and outlets to act on those values, and that reminds you that we have a responsibility to one another. And I think that that, you know, as grateful as I am that, you know, this data on the disaffiliation from institutional religion shows that we're becoming more open as a society. People can change their religious identity. They can leave their religious identity without facing the kinds of social repercussions that they may have faced in the past. And I celebrate that. I also, at the same time, worry about the loss of institutions for people who have decided that a religious institution is not serving them anymore. And I think that the humanist community needs to invest much more in building up supportive resources, like our counterparts in Europe, for example. I think the largest life stance community in Norway is the humanist community, and they have a coming of age program for young adults. They have all these really amazing resources. And here in the United States, humanism has not is not nearly as far along in building up these kinds of supportive structures. And I just think they're so vital.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious then, as people in religious, who's often in religious circles and does a lot of interfaith work, I know one of the issues you care about a lot is community service, and used to kind of run, I think, the community service aspects that were happening at Harvard. And figuring out how to incorporate non-theists or atheists into interfaith spaces.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, because I know from when I was a student and from what I see with students, I think there are dual misconceptions that are driving at each other that really make it difficult for a lot of people. On the one hand, I think atheists feel like they're written out of most religious spaces. Like, you don't believe in God, you have no place here. And that is challenging. And then on the other hand, a lot of religious people feel like because so much of the public sphere is often secular, and I'm like choosing my words very carefully because figuring out what that means is as secular versus kind of normative Protestant in the United States is a different story. But if you're like, you have other spaces to be atheist, I have no other space to be religious or to be with other religious people. So how do you bring those people together? What do you tell the religious person who's like, whenever I go to a Bible class, it's by definition an atheist classroom to me, and I want to just talk to religious people now. I don't want to have to deal with you atheist, or to the atheist person who is kind of searching for that community and now being told that, like, how do we bring those people in?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. It's like a very multi-layered question.
So multi-layered.
So, I mean,
because as I was asking it, I then in my head was jumping to, I was watching a video, you were on the O'Reilly show, and you're talking about, like, religious spaces and Christmas trees versus all religious symbols versus, and it gets very, very, very complicated.
Yeah. So I want to circle back to O'Reilly in a minute because I have something that I think you'll find interesting. But before that, I mean, I think it sort of depends on what the goal of the conversation is, and I try to determine that early on, because sometimes I encounter, like, interfaith conversations where it's less about trying to find our shared humanity and understand one another better, which, in that conversation, I think absolutely atheists and humanists must be included.
Right.
And it's more a conversation around the shared experience of being religious,
right,
in which case maybe I don't have as much to contribute. And that's, you know, so, you know, when you were referencing, what do you say to a student who says, you know, I really want to just talk with other religious people about the experience of being religious? I think that's fine.
Yeah.
But I do think that the project of trying to understand one another and develop a common shared language for talking about what our responsibilities are to one another and how we can, you know, live the best collective life possible, well, then absolutely, that's a conversation that transcends the experience of being religious, and it's something that should include everyone. I do think that service, which you mentioned just a minute ago, is probably one of the best entry points into that conversation,
for sure,
because everyone has an ethic of service, right? And for some people that ethic is rooted in a religious worldview, and for others it's not. But it's a great space to not only recognize that we have similar goals, but also for us to explore what the language is, what the sort of shared common language around the value of helping others is. Whereas there are certain interfaith activities that are perhaps a little bit more closed but have a different goal.
Right.
Like an interfaith prayer service, it's a little harder for me as an atheist to be a part of that.
Right.
However, I also, and I understand there will be others who don't agree with this, but I have a bit of a problem with interfaith prayer services in general, because they sort of operate on this assumption that all religious people and all religious traditions have prayer as a part of the life of their tradition, and that's not the case.
Yeah.
And so I'm, you know, I much prefer sort of vigils or solidarity.
We use the vigil model at NYU a lot after tragedy, and Anne, she's having a great podcast, and Anne Clayson speaks at these very often, and she's fantastic at bringing in a piece of wisdom from a text or even, I think she's brought a song a few times that come from a humanist lens that nobody in the crowd is familiar with. And it does really provide actually a fantastic lens that really can speak to the tragedy and that provides a really nice complement to having a rabbi and an imam and a pastor up there as well.
Well, and this is exactly why I really urge fellow humanists and atheists to be a part of these kinds of events, because without that presence there, it, you know, you'll often will see that it's simply religious leaders offering religious expressions. And again, nothing wrong with that. But if for the atheist or the humanist in the crowd who is processing this tragic experience in their own way, to not feel as if their perspective is being reflected and included in this, I think can exacerbate the feelings of isolation or loneliness that can arise in these kinds of situations. So, you know, there's a real there's an opportunity for representation and an opportunity for education as well. I mean, one of the things that I love most about being in an interfaith space is that I'm challenged and I learn a lot. It's a hugely educational space for me, and it's a space for me to come up against my own boundaries and edges and to be challenged to articulate what my beliefs and identity are for a group of people who I can't just assume are already on the same page as me. And I think this is actually a really important exercise for humanists, because in our culture, in this cultural moment right now, humanists and atheists are much more frequently defined by what they don't believe than by what they do.
And viewed negatively more so by people who believe differently.
But it really wasn't until I started getting involved in interfaith activities that I started developing a coherent moral identity of my own. I mean, for years I was identifying as non-religious, as atheist, and, you know, I was defining myself in the negative. And when I started getting involved in interfaith work, specifically both in my master's program and when I was interning at the Interfaith Youth Corps, I started finding myself, I would hear my religious peers talking about the richness of their tradition, of their worldview, and I found myself saying, well, I'm not this and I'm not that. And at one point, Ibu from IFYC pulled me aside and he said, you know, Chris, I don't want to tell you what you are or how you should identify, but, you know, I hear in a lot of what you're saying this worldview of humanism, and I'm wondering if you're familiar with it, if you think that this resonates with you. And he pointed me in the direction of some resources, and it was through the process of being in conversation with people who didn't share my views that I started to discover more about what my views are and what my identity is.
And I feel like developing a moral conscience or a personal ethic is really should be part of college students' development. And it's definitely, I think it happens, it'll happen less frequently in your history or chemistry class than it'll happen in meeting other people, your involvement in extracurriculars, involvement in student affairs.
Yeah, and a big part of why I do the chaplaincy or chaplaincy equivalent work.
There's still not a perfect word for it.
There's really not, and you know, I think a lot of it is situational. Like when I was at Harvard, I used the term humanist chaplain because all 40 or so of the professionals who did the work that we did use the word chaplain, and so I think some of it's just contextual.
Yeah,
but
so much.
But big part of why I do the pastoral care work that I do in higher ed is because college is a very unique time in a person's life where you, for many people anyway, you're encountering, you know, beliefs and backgrounds that you had never encountered before, and you're not just encountering them for a moment, you're living in close community with them, you're in the classroom with them, you're in the dining hall with them, and you're also asking, both in the classroom and outside, these big moral and existential questions, and you're, for many people, myself included, encountering ideas and questions that you hadn't wrestled with before. And it's a huge time of identity formation and development, and moral identity development in particular. And when I was in college, I went to a wonderful Christian college, but it was when I was in college that I realized that I was an atheist. And I just felt like my Christian peers had these wonderful pastoral resources, and I just didn't have a space that I could turn. And that's a big part of what motivates and animates the work I do now, is reflecting on how much I would have benefited from having a community and a resource like that when I was going through that process. And I find it very rewarding to do that work with students now. And one of the nicest things about it is I'm still in process, right? I'm still developing my own identity, and I get to do that work in my work with students, and that's huge for me.
Yeah. So I wanna ask, because we start talking about your appearance on Bill O'Reilly, and it actually I think it gets to actually a fundamentally very complicated question when incorporating humanists into interfaith spaces, which is we did an episode recently that was talking about Licite in France and how in French culture the neutrality of the public space takes precedence often over the expression of a personal religious identity. And as someone who wears a kippah every day, that troubles me in a lot of ways, and I feel very strongly about and I agree with what you said, O'Reilly, Christmas trees don't bother me. I think it's great to have Christmas trees as long as the public space also accommodates for a menorah and a symbol for Kwanzaa and whatever else is happening. I think everyone expressing their religious identity publicly or a spiritual identity or a moral identity publicly is a better world where nobody can. So I guess the question is, when we're organizing a holiday party and we want to have symbols, how do we do it? What are the symbols? How do we create symbols and spaces that are more open and inclusive and that can be as welcoming to the atheist who comes to the holiday party as they are to the Jewish person who sees the menorah? I'm like, I know what that is.
Yeah. I love that you asked this question. Do you know what we're working on at Yale Humanist Community right now?
No,
or is
but
this just totally coincidence?
I mean, it's probably totally coincidence, but it's probably not coincidence because this is something I think about a lot,
sure.
And we both work in higher ed in
yes.
this field, so
yes.
I imagine we're both
so
thinking about similar
this is,
questions.
I mean, it's a huge question for humanism, the like symbology of humanism, and
yeah.
You know, there are some humanists who are like hugely suspicious of symbols of any kind or efforts to sort of organize around a sort of consensus-driven, you know, even the Humanist Manifesto, there are three editions. One of the first things I read about humanism, one of the first times when I was reading through it and I was saying, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not a perfect match, but pretty close.
Yeah.
The Humanist Manifesto was created by consensus, but there are also a lot of humanists who disagree with it or who disagree with aspects of it. It's hard. And this is,
yeah.
I mean, this is true in religious communities as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, we wrestle with a sort of shared identity and what the how to express that in a way that reflects everyone. But I think for humanists who haven't inherited the same kind of robust tradition
right.
and set of symbols and stories that religious communities have, it's like that much more difficult.
Right.
And
in some ways it feels less authentic until it's been used for long enough
right.
that it has a tradition behind it, but someone has to be it has to start
right.
at some point.
I know, it's like, and this goes far beyond symbols to just
yeah.
the very like core of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes I talk with professional peers who are religious and they say, oh, I really envy you because you don't inherit all this baggage that, you know, I inherit in my religious tradition. And I have to say, I envy you because you inherit all this baggage that's full of all of this, you know, all these really rich resources and a kind of common language that, like,
yeah.
we just don't have in the humanist community. So, I mean, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side.
True.
There's, you know, there are, we have, on the one hand, this really exciting kind of creative opportunity, but
mm-hmm.
we have all, I mean, it's going to be a long and difficult process.
Right.
So in humanism, there is this happy humanist symbol that some people really like. I have to say, I'll go on the record as saying, not a huge fan of it personally, but for those who enjoy it, that's fine. But to me, it feels like it was created because we needed a symbol.
Yeah.
And so we made a symbol that was an H that looked like a human and it represented humanism, and that's fine. But I'm interested in trying to experiment and see what emerges more sort of organically
mm-hmm.
from humanism. Much like in, you know, are you familiar at all with Sunday Assembly?
No.
So Sunday Assembly is this atheist or non-religious church that was started in the UK by two stand-up comedians and has spread around the world. I actually spoke at the first meeting of the Sunday Assembly here in New York City. Sunday Assembly is clearly responding to a need that people have. You know, there are a growing number of non-religious people who want to gather And celebrate and reflect. And we do it too at the Yale Humanist Community. We have Sunday meetings twice a month, and they're our fastest growing program. Mm-hmm. But one thing that strikes me about Sunday Assembly, and I think that a number of people who are doing really great work in Sunday Assembly would probably acknowledge that this is the case, is that it, one thing that I think is related to this question you ask about Sunday Assembly is that, and again, I'm sure it varies from community to community, but the Sunday assemblies I've gone to have kind of felt like a Protestant service where they stripped out the theology and references to God, but kept it largely intact. They're singing, there's a sermon, there's, you know, these pieces. And to me, it felt like church. And again, I think some people really like that about it, but to me, it doesn't feel like a sort of like organic expression of humanism that emerges from conversation about, you know, what are we all about? And rather it comes from looking at something that works and saying that works. We should just do our own version of that, which I think is...
It's hard.
Yeah, it's hard.
As someone who really struggles with both attendance and just enjoying myself in synagogue, the idea of having to completely re-engineer it from the bottom up sounds incredibly overwhelming as well at the same time. Like that's
which is why I think, you know, there's this sense that at least for now we'll just sort of look at what works in a religious tradition, adapt it, but it'll sort of feel similar. And that's fine, but I think that the more exciting project is trying to figure out sort of what is organically and authentically a sort of humanist service or gathering. And that we're experimenting with that with our Sunday programs, and sometimes we try things and people are into it, and sometimes we try things and it doesn't feel right. But I do think that it's not the kind of thing that can be developed overnight. It just takes time. And there are people who are doing really exciting stuff around this. There are people who are working on trying to develop humanist rituals. There are people who are trying to develop... there were a couple of students at Harvard that I was working with who were trying to develop a kind of humanist liturgical calendar. And, you know, I just think that those things are really exciting. And that brings me back to the O'Reilly thing and the religion in the public square question. You know, when I was on O'Reilly, that it was such a surreal experience. It was totally last minute. They like contacted me the day of, and I mean, I just hate this about our culture in general, is that we're supposed to have these fully formed, coherent positions on things the moment that we hear about them. I mean, it's a big part of why I've stepped back from some of my blogging work, and because I just find that like my perspective on something is always changing the more I learn, and so it's really hard to sort of stake out a fixed position on anything. But you know, I still a couple of years later now stand by what I said on the show about I'm much more interested in seeing humanists respond to these public expressions of religious identity or religious symbols by coming up with something to contribute rather than trying to take those things away. And so the reason I asked if you knew what we were doing at the Yale Humanist Community is that this year, technically last year now, I guess, a couple of weeks ago in December, we launched something called the Greenlight Project, where our goal is that this coming December, well, actually probably in November is when we'd unveil it, we will unveil an original art installation on the town green in New Haven to represent the beliefs and values of humanists and the non-religious, to stand alongside the religious symbols that go up on the green every year. And we hope that it will be a gift to the city, that people will enjoy it, and that it will be a sort of beautiful thing, that it will also provide an opportunity for people to gather and, you know, come together during this cold, dark time of the year to create light and warmth. But we also hope on a symbolic level that its presence on the town green alongside the religious symbols will show that we stand alongside our religious neighbors and that we're all members of the same community with something to contribute. And I think that that is a voice, I think this is actually the, like, language I use on O'Reilly. That is the voice, that's the yes of atheism and humanism that goes unheard so often. And I think that it could do a lot to challenge some of the misconceptions that people have about non-believers, that we're fixated on taking away other people's...
Deconstructing.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
Yeah, rather than focused on building and mm-hmm. contributing. And, you know, there are certainly times, I think, where it's appropriate to challenge the presence of a dominant
mm-hmm.
religious...
Right. Well, that's... You always want to be careful. You don't want to privilege having a religious identity or having specific religious identities while pushing people who maybe not be contributing to
right.
contribute.
Well, and a member of our board of directors who's on the Greenlight Project Committee recently wrote a piece for USA Today where he was essentially arguing that
mm-hmm.
humanists and atheists should contribute something during this season
right.
to these public displays rather than try and take something away. But he made a point in his op-ed, which is true, which is that sometimes humanists do try to do that and they're told no, and that's how they end up
right.
with these lawsuits.
Totally.
And then it ends up no one gets anything
right.
On display. And so I understand when it comes
mm-hmm.
to that, but wouldn't it be so much nicer for everyone if the response was, yes, we welcome your contributions
right.
just as we welcome everyone else's.
Yeah.
That's the response I would hope to see.
I couldn't agree more. I don't... Probably not everyone agrees with this, with us on this one. But
sure.
I definitely agree. And I hope that you can start creating some of these symbols. I hope that our holiday party next year can steal some of what you're doing up at Yale. And
sure,
we can contribute as well.
I hope so, too. I think by the time this podcast is released, the deadline for artists will have passed because it's this month.
Mm-hmm.
But we're currently casting as wide a net as we can and inviting artists to submit their ideas. I would not think that I have the best ideas for what this symbol
right.
should be. And so I'm hoping we'll get some really great ideas and that we'll be able to land on something that is an authentic representation of humanist values. So we'll see. I'm
great.
Excited.
Yeah, I'm excited too. And thank you so much for joining us today and for giving us your time.
Oh, thanks. It was my pleasure. Happy to have the conversation.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. I'd especially like to thank our guest this week, Chris Stedman, for joining us for such a fun interview. Sorry for those of you who are looking for a student this week. We take this during winter break, and there was literally not a single student in the entire building, so no one who could join us on the interview. Special thank you to Brian Young for editing and producing this podcast in absentia. Thank you to Liz Suatos, whose music is from the Alphabetic Film. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and thank you for listening. We look forward to having you back for another episode.